It's that time again. Time for another three-day community festival at Good in the Hood 2015, which is sure to bring even more than before. Starting June 26th through June 28th at Lil's Albina Park, there will be a celebration of community with live music, kid space, lots of local foods, and a chance for health screening too. KBOO is also in the Good in the Hood parade, and we want our members and volunteers to participate. For more information, contact Ani Haynes at volunteer@kboo.org. Again, Good in the Hood, Friday, June 26th through Sunday, June 28th. And KBOO will be broadcasting live on Saturday, June 27th. See you in the hood.
I know it's a lot of bad out there, but guess what?
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO. Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
Welcome to Between the Covers. I'm your host, Kathleen Stevenson. My guest today is Polly Dugan, award-winning author of So Much a Part of You, a collection of short stories, and The Sweetheart Deal, her first novel. Polly lives in Portland. She is a former employee of Powell's Books. She is an alumna of the Tin House Writers Workshop and a reader at Tin House Magazine. Her short fiction has been featured as a narrative story of the week and awarded an honorable mention in Glimmer Train's Short Story Award for New Writers Contest. Polly Dugan, welcome back to Between the Covers.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. The Sweetheart Deal is what we're going to be talking about today, and it is the story of a Portland family, a family with three sons. The father, Leo, is a firefighter. His longtime best friend is Garrett. One night after both men have been drinking, Leo makes Garrett promise that if Leo dies, Garrett will marry his wife, Audrey. 12 years later, Leo does die unexpectedly, so the novel is about what happens to the family and Garrett in the wake of Leo's death. Can you talk a little about the spark for this novel? The starting point was the premise of this promise, or was it something else?
Well, it's been really fun to talk about that, because to go back just a little further, when I was querying my now agent, Wendy Sherman, with the story collection that was finished, and one of her questions early in our exchanges was, are you working on a novel? And the answer was honestly no, but I knew that the answer that she was looking for and hoping was yes. And surely, I think by the grace of the muse, I came up with an idea. It's based on the promise. And that stems, in fact, from a very real situation, but not nearly as sort of binding as it is in the book, between my best friend from college and me. We've known each other now for over 20 years, maybe 30. But back in 2000, when she visited Portland and spent some time with my husband, we had both seen each other through less than successful romantic relationships. And she and my husband, Patrick, are very good friends in their own right. And we just came up with this very glib, funny thing, because she and I are so much alike, and she and Patrick hit it off, that if I die, she had to marry Patrick. And that was really the start and the end of it. And then when I thought, this book deal is not going to happen if you can't have something in the way of a really compelling idea for a novel. And that was where it started, with that promise. What would two chivalric men do with that on Y2K when they've been drinking? Remember how weird everyone was Y2K? We just didn't know it was going to happen. So that particular setting set things up to be dire. And when you're a firefighter, you have it a dangerous profession. And of course, that's not what results in his death. But Leo is the kind of character that wanted to take care of business as much as he could. So It started with that between two friends.
I read that you had a somewhat unconventional outline process for this book. Talk about that, and did that come to you right after you had the idea for the book, or was that a longer process?
No, it was much later. And again, this all happened in the beginning of 2013. And once the book deal had been negotiated with Little Brown, that was the end of March. And having been to Tin House, to the workshop, three prior years, I had at that point been accepted to be in Karen Shepherd's novel writing workshop for July of 2013. The previous three workshops I'd done had been short story. And after much deliberation, I made the decision to withdraw from Karen's workshop, as much as I'd been looking forward to working with her, and just audit the conference, which meant that I could go to lectures and panels and readings, but I would not be attending classroom time because I had really a specific person to be writing for. I was working with my editor, and as valuable as the workshop environment may have been, it might have taken me in all kinds of digressive different directions that ultimately wouldn't work. It was really a process I had to think long and hard about. So what I ended up doing, and this was a great structure for me, is I would go down to Reed campus where the workshop is held every year, be there for the 9 o'clock lecture, and then when everyone broke off to their classrooms at 10, I would just write from 10 to 12:30. And that was when I did the outline. So it wasn't till July. And I think part of the reason that it emerged was because, having worked in the short form for such a long time, feeling more comfortable there in a sense, I had ideas about Audrey's arc and storyline, and Garrett's, and then the three boys, Christopher and Brian and Andrew, and then about how they would all intersect. And there was too much happening in my mind mentally at the same time that I just had to get it out. And it wasn't even so much of an outline as it was kind of a drawing or a diagram or what I viewed as a map, because I just had lists of adjectives by each character, what were going to be the pertinent things about them individually, and then the pertinent things about them with other people instrumental in the story and in their particular circumstances. So it happened much later, and it was really fun to kind of talk about that on Medium, is a website that featured that, and then I did a Periscope broadcast in May right before Pub, in which I showed that outline, and it was really fun to recall how valuable that had been.
The book is written from the perspective of several different people. Audrey's viewpoint, Garrett's viewpoint, Leo, who dies, but his viewpoint is also in the book, and the three sons. What was that like to write from all those different viewpoints in this book?
I really thought the way to go, first person, and I thought about this a lot. My story collection, all the stories are written close third, and the narrators in each of those stories are different ages, and some are men, some are women, some are boys, some are girls. And I think because of the just really emotional, how emotionally raw I was going to make these characters, it felt the most compassionate to sort of tell myself, well, if you're going to do this to someone, maybe you should get in their skin and their shoes and see how that feels, and also to really honor what I hope was going to be the authenticity of those emotions. It just felt a little more not only effective but also compassionate to do it first person. And I went back and forth. You know, it's easy to do when you're working on the computer and save as and do find and replace a name with a pronoun or a pronoun with a different pronoun. It just felt a little too removed. I also really enjoyed it. I had a lot of fun being a 15-year-old boy in that circumstance. You know, when I was a child, I really wanted to be an actress, and I was so shy. I've never been in a school play. I've never pursued any of that. And I think sometimes in writing, that's the closest that I feel like I've been able to get to taking on another role, if you will. Mm-hmm. And writers do, right? We do that. The characters ended up becoming composites of how I could best serve them, and also what I might have borrowed from someone whose characteristics would help round that out. I really enjoyed it a lot, and I feel proud when it's worked. I don't think close third would have worked as well.
Right, because they're all, unifying factor is they're all dealing with this incredible loss of Leo and what that means. So in a way, it's It's like all these different perspectives on that loss. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about this as such a central theme in the book, and you've sort of touched on it, putting yourself in this family with this incredible loss, and I guess what that was like for you.
Steve Almond, one of my mentors, has said in multiple places in lectures, and then he writes about this in a craft book, to the question that writers ask, you know, what should I be writing about? His answer is, what you can't get rid of any other way. And I've lost both my parents. My mother passed away from metastatic breast cancer in late 2003, when I had just recently become a mother for the first time in January of that same year. And we were very close. And so loss meant something different to me, but before I had that experience. And I think it's the one circumstance that changes in such a profound way, for lack of a better word, kind of your emotional DNA. And you can have success at work or in relationship or have your first child, but you know, loss and grief, you know, following the death of someone beloved is just so, it's just so unique and different. And, you know, maybe in part it's because in the United States, we handle that differently sometimes than other countries do. So it's a little bit of an obsession of mine, and also something that I joke about being exposure therapy, because, you know, if you're really afraid of sharks or whatever, you're supposed to spend a lot of time learning about sharks. And so when I'm writing, I put my characters sometimes through an awful lot of mess so that I can also help them come out the other side and be resilient and survive those really horrible circumstances that they've been up against. So approaching writing about all the characters' really deep sense of loss, I know what that feels like. And then I could only imagine it. You know, I don't know what it's like to lose my husband. I hope it's a very long time before either one of us knows that. But I could superimpose what I felt about losing both my parents onto a wife, because I am married and I've been married for a long time. And then because I have lost a parent, imagine the boys, they're much younger than I was when I lost my parents. And then same thing, you know, with Garrett, with a friend. It's our own mortalities that we all face. It's just, you know, it's just a fact of being alive. And again, because it's an obsession, I just try to reconcile it the best I can. And sometimes it means exploring rather dark emotional terrain. But that's what I'm drawn to. So I'll do it as long as it works.
I'm speaking with Portland writer Polly Dugan on Between the Covers on KBOO Radio. I'm Kathleen Stevenson. And we're talking about her new novel, The Sweetheart Deal. And this might be a time where we could hear something from The Sweetheart Deal. Polly, do you want to introduce what we're going to hear?
Yes, I'd be happy to. And after just having talked about some darker, sadder things, after having experienced them myself, I have put into my work, I'd like to read from a chapter of Audrey's fairly early in the book. And it's her take, what's happening on the night before the funeral, the viewing, and then the day of the funeral. I thought the calling hours would never end, and that we might stand there all night until the last patient mourners, after waiting so long, were able to share their condolences just in time for us to leave and go directly to the funeral. There were so many people, strangers I'd never seen before, among the hundreds of faces I recognized, police officers, paramedics, firefighters and their families, and families from the school, the church, the street and neighborhood, the boys' preschool, the sports teams. They all waited for as long as it took for their own turns to talk to us. I didn't think I'd sleep the night before the funeral, but the few hours I did took the edge off enough that I didn't feel so raw and like I couldn't cope, but barely. I didn't know how I could have gotten through it without Erin. I couldn't have. That morning she asked me if I wanted a Xanax. She was a terrible flyer, and I told her no, and sobbed in the bathroom alone despite the whiskey I nursed while I showered and dressed and dried my hair. There wasn't anything that could dull my sorrow or enough of anything to blunt the ordeal of burying my husband. Erin wouldn't let me do a thing that day, acting as the hostess in her own house, refusing offers from helpful guests. She scrambled eggs while the coffee brewed, one pot after the other, as mugs were drained and refilled. She cooked and fed everyone who would eat. Her son, Michael, had been Brian's best friend since kindergarten, bringing us together in the process, and over those 8 years, she had earned the right to take over and to take care of me. Since Leo died, she had been there at least once a day, bringing Michael with her, and sometimes her 9-year-old daughter, Rory, taking charge after people started to drop off meals. She had marked all the containers' lids with the dates and stacked them in the basement chest freezer, with the oldest ones on top. There were too many flowers to manage. They overwhelmed me, and after covering every possible surface in the living and dining rooms, Erin ferried the ones that came later to the addition, a room I avoided. She put the arrangements on boards laid over the floor joists around the room's stark skeletal perimeter. Then when they passed their prime, as soon as they started dropping leaves, she got them out of the house and into the compost bin. After we had all gotten through the morning and it was time to leave for the church, everyone filed out of the house and piled into the limos the funeral home had sent along with the hearse. But Andrew wasn't with them. I found him in bed fully clothed, his shoes still on, bunkered in his comforter, which I peeled away as I coaxed him out as best I could. "Andrew, I would give almost anything right now to crawl in there with you," I said. "But I can't do this without you. Please, sweetie, you have to come."
Did you, in the writing of this book, did you learn anything about what it takes to for someone to recover and prevail after the loss of a loved one like that?
I'll have to think about that for a minute. I'm sure I'm not the only writer to say this, but I get a lot of inspiration from my characters. That might sound a little bit strange and, for lack of a better word, woo-woo, because I've made them up, you know. But sometimes we make our characters do things that we're not brave enough to do, or that we're not bad enough to do. And I think that's just one of the sort of vicarious pleasures of writing and creating art. I've obviously survived, you know, the loss of both of my parents. I mean, emotionally, I'm very different than before they passed away. But I think with all of these characters, we took them down to a really dark, bad place. You know, what's that about hitting bottom? You know, the only place you can go is up. Well, no, or you can just stay there, you know, at the bottom, right? Yeah. And I think that there is so much about love and community and relationships and the family we create, both our like biological one having children and also the family we create from really close friends, that until some stuff pretty dire happens, you don't realize the depth of those resources that you can tap for recovery. And I have those kinds of relationships. I feel really blessed too. And so I think that's what I reinforced or learned, if it answers your question, in this book, that there's something really powerful in being vulnerable and asking for help, and something really powerful in being the person who gives that help. And you know, certainly we haven't talked about this yet, but there's an unlikely relationship at the center of the story. And I also think that sometimes, it, depending on how life goes for us, a person can have more than one great love. You know, people live so much longer now than they used to. And that's something that, given the internet and people in our lives who we know, we see that happen all the time. And that was another thing that I explored here. Garrett's sort of an unlikely mate, mm-hmm. under years of circumstances. And I don't want to be a spoiler, but when things align in a certain way, he doesn't shy away from that particular emotional challenge.
Yeah, so you're talking about the relationship between Garrett, the friend of Leo, mm-hmm. and Audrey, mm-hmm. who you just read her voice. I believe you mentioned some of the research that you did for this. Yeah. And there were a number of areas that you must have had to research, I think, unless you have had personal experience with, say, someone dying in a ski accident. And that was on Mount Hood in the
right.
book.
Right. And I haven't, thankfully.
Yeah. Who did you talk to for that, or what kind of research did you do for that?
That was so important to me at the beginning, especially because there was a certain amount of intimidation that I was really feeling, having made the commitment to write a novel. So early on, it was something easy for me to approach, to sort of give myself permission to do research. It was work. I wasn't generating pages, but it was still really necessary work. And when I've read books and there's some authenticity that I'm familiar with and it's missed in the book, I really feel like that's was so avoidable. And if I've picked it up, it's a disappointment for a reader. So there's another parent at my son's school, and he's an ER doc who has worked up at the hospitals. I believe it's a Providence hospital at Meadows at Mount Hood. And he's not experienced the situation that I set up for Leo's accident, but we talked a lot about what being on the ground there is like when an accident does happen, when it's a non-fatality. And then he talked to some people to help get the authenticity that I was looking for. So he was really, really instrumental and was so committed to helping me with what I had asked of him. And then I sent him the pages after we'd met and sort of exchanged back and forth emails to let me know that he thought that I'd gotten it the best I could. The other thing that meant so much to me is the Dougie Center, which is here in town, does amazing work with grieving children and families. Donna Sherman there and I spent a really emotional afternoon just talking about the critical work of helping families and children heal, because, you know, I literally rip these kids, you know, sort of peace of mind out from under them. And then I had to follow up on taking care of them. And that was so valuable. And then, of course, I was raised Catholic and my kids go to Catholic school, and I make this family, you know, a Catholic family, and I incorporate that community into it. And so the parish priest at the Madeleine, Mike Beowind, is someone with whom I have a relationship, and he's the parish pastor. And he was very agreeable to sit down. I said, "Can you talk to me about what you might say to a woman in this complex situation?" And he was very generous. I mean, everyone was generous. And my husband and I are friends with a firefighter and his wife, and so I had them vet certain portions of that. It was imperative to me that I got those cultural aspects right. Then certainly not the least of all of this was that I write about friendship a lot in the first book, female friendship, and a little bit, but I really wanted to get the friendship between Leo and Garrett absolutely as spot on as I could, being a woman. And so I came up with a survey and asked trusted male friends if they would respond to it. And they were very generous and honest and candid and personal with their responses. And as a result of that survey and those collective responses, the axis of the book changed. In my original proposal, Garrett and Leo were dear friends from college, because the joke that started the whole thing was with my dear friend from college. And what I got back was that so many friendships that these men were referencing happened in high school and happened around the time that they were trying to navigate adolescence and puberty and, you know, being young men together. And often one of the unifying factors was sports. And so certainly that it comes through in the book. So every place where I had a little bit of personal and creative doubt, I just got as much help as I could. And it was a great part of the process. I loved it.
You say that you got your writing training at Tin House, at the workshops. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you can talk a little bit more about how that experience trained you, how it informed your work so much.
Yeah. Whenever I talk about my writing sort of education, in quotes, if you will, Tin House is always a really significant part of the answer. I had creative writing for a year in college with Bob Olmsted, who's a terrific writer and was a great mentor. And that was the first time that I had even endeavored to attempt to write fiction. And his teaching and his feedback let me know that I wasn't wasting my time. He was a good teacher. After I graduated in the late 80s, MFA programs were places that aspiring writers went to, and I loved school, but I was ready to be out in the world. And my first job actually was in publishing in New York City, Prentice Hall Press, which at that time was a division of Simon & Schuster, with their trade books, travel and cookbooks and things like that. And I started and tried to write a lot of things that went nowhere during that time. But I was doing a lot of living. I did a lot of living in my 20s. And so when my boys were young, probably in 2006, and not as demanding, I had long stretches of time, I got some ideas for some stories and even returned to some of those projects from my 20s and even two stories from my class with Bob. When Finn, my older son Finn, started kindergarten, I became friendly with Holly MacArthur, who had helped to start Tin House Magazine. And I just discovered the workshop being at Reed every summer. And I just thought, oh, well, I'm in Portland. It's in Portland. I'll apply. And I got accepted. And I was very, very nervous because I didn't have any MFA or workshopping experience. And the first year in 2010, I worked with Joy Williams. And then in 2011 with Steve Almond. And then in 2012 with Elisa Chappelle. And I also had a mentorship with Meg Story, who is an editor at Tin House Books, because I had completed the collection and it was time to get some professional treatment, if you would, an editorial treatment. The thing that was incredible for my development as a writer about the workshops is that not only did I have such razor-sharp attention given to my work by all of my workshop leaders, who are just tremendous writers and very generous and talented teachers, but I also had my peer group. And in workshop, everyone's at a different stage of their writing. So you leave that week with all kinds of directions that your work can go, but getting a sense that you're not wasting your time. I mean, that was a huge takeaway for me. And then beyond that, such talented, accomplished writers are not only giving craft lectures and having panel discussions that gave me information that I couldn't have gotten anywhere else. And then after you have lectures and panel discussions and workshops, you're able to sit down and have access to these writers who are so supportive and have been exactly where all of us were in all of our stages. And it's really, really intimate. And it's really so comprehensive that every year that I could go back, when there was still more that I could get from it, I did, even up until like 2013. I wrote, but then I also took everything that I could from the craft lectures. And I got an incredible amount that year that helped me with the book. So I'm just really fortunate.
And you're a reader for Tin House?
Yeah, so I'm a submissions reader for the magazine. And that's just also another really great thing for a writer to do, you know, developing sort of your critical faculty, because when you're writing, you're so close to your own work. That's why you need other feedback. That's why you need your own readers. And then when you're reading someone else's work, you can so easily spot what's not working in someone else's piece that you yourself are and have been guilty of. And it just heightens your awareness. Wow, I'm so confused. Who are he and she? But you don't do that with your own work, because in your mind, you know, you fill in those blanks, if you will. So it's really a privilege to be able to participate in the magazine.
Well, I want to thank you very much for speaking with me, and enjoy talking with you and reading The Sweetheart Deal. Thank you so much for coming into KBOO again.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's been such a pleasure to talk about the book.
Monday the 6th of July, Polly Dugan will be at Annie Bloom's Books with Robin McLean.
Yep, in conversation with her.
Yep. Okay, great. And that's at 7 p.m. That's Monday the 6th of July at Annie Bloom's. And then Saturday the 22nd, you're going to be at Cannon Beach Book Company in Cannon Beach at 2 p.m.
Right. That's going to be just for a two-hour window of signing. Oh. That store has been really so supportive of both books. And my family loves Cannon Beach and I love that store. And it's just, they have tried to do some readings and space is just a little bit of an issue. So I'm delighted that I'll be down there signing. And then I'll be up in Seattle, also at University Bookstore on July 10th, which is a Friday.
Well, again, thank you very much. I've been speaking with Polly Dugan. She is a Portlander, and her latest book, her novel, is The Sweetheart Deal, which is what we've been talking about today. This is Kathleen Stevenson for Between the Covers on KBOO Radio. If you missed part of this interview or want to hear it again, you can go online to kboo.fm/betweenthecovers. Thanks for listening.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 28th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place July 2nd through 5th at Waterfront Park in Portland. Four stages, 100 performers, including the Greg Allman Band, Galactic with Macy Gray, and Buddy Guy. There will be after-hours performances, shows on the Portland Spirit, and much more. Again, that's the 28th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, Thursday, July 2nd through Sunday, July 5th at Waterfront Park in Portland. For more information, go to kboo.fm/waterfrontbluesfestival2015.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, salads, and wraps, located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Film Show on KBOO. I'm SW Conser.
And I'm Jen Chavez. Today we'll be talking with a Seattle filmmaker whose mythological skate punk movie has never been seen in Portland until now. The Oregon Historical Society and the Hollywood Theater are teaming up to screen the cult classic Shredder Orpheus tomorrow night at 9:30, and we'll hear from the director, Robert McGinley.
And we'll also be joined by visionary animator Rose Bond, who will be leading the biennial Boundary Crossings program.